Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's Brian Lehrer, and this is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Tuesday, June 9th. On this day of George Floyd's funeral in Houston, it's not just Americans who are watching, the whole world is watching. And we will get a global view now from Christian Amanpour, CNN's chief international correspondent and host of Amanpour & Company on PBS. Christian, it's so nice of you to make some time for us today. Welcome back to WNYC.
Always good to be with you, Brian.
How much would you say the whole world has reacted to the killing of George Floyd?
Well, to be honest with you, I would say a huge amount. You listed some of the protests that have been going on ever since he was killed on Memorial Day in your country. And the reaction was almost instantaneous. I mean, not just on the streets, which has been pretty constant in all the capitals you mentioned, with the murals, with the, you know, even in more far-flung places, which may not have black minorities, but which also have histories of oppression and injustice and ethnic repression. So this is something that is really touched a nerve. And not only that, I'll just say this at this point, it's also sort of got even America's adversaries, even in the leadership area, to when they seem to be lectured by President Trump, for instance, the Chinese immediately tweeted back from the foreign ministry, "I can't breathe." In Iran, the foreign minister tweeted, "Black Lives Matter." I mean, you can add a level of somewhat hypocrisy to those if you like, but the fact of the matter is that from the top of the halls of power to the streets, this has created and caused a massive wave of solidarity and attention around the world.
Neither racism itself nor cases of American police violence caught on video are new. Why do you think this case touched off the global reaction you were just describing so much more than previous ones?
Well, look, I think I leave it to the black community in the United States to describe for themselves why. I think the most overriding message that I have received is exhaustion and just enough is enough. It's just enough. And I think in the rest of the world, you have also solidarity movements, but you also have many countries which are not only still grappling with their colonial and racist past, well, even the one I'm sitting in right now, London, the United Kingdom, we can talk about that in a moment. Mm-hmm. But in many of the other places, in parts of the Middle East, in parts of, you know, you can imagine amongst the Palestinians, amongst many, many people, a history of oppression is something that, you know, they've been protesting against for a long, long time. So they perhaps see this unacceptable use of brute force against George Floyd as the straw that breaks the camel's back, the tipping point, particularly in the political and cultural and social and economic environment that we find ourselves in now and for the past several years.
Christian, do you want to talk more about the UK, since that's where you are? What's happening there today?
Yes, I do. And today actually is kind of interesting because, as you know, and I've spoken, we have had rolling protests since they started in the United States. Big, big protests. And not just the black community, but others as well coming out in solidarity. And I think that's also a major thing to point out, that it's cross-cultural. People coming out to support the black community, knowing that this is, you know, finally an unacceptable level of persistent violence that despite every lost life, and including here in the UK, clearly it is not the same situation in terms of police violence here as it is in the United States. But we do, and we have had, black boys and men killed unarmed by police. So this is a big, big issue. And of course, we exist at the same time in a situation where, like in the United States, the people bearing the brunt of the infections and the deaths and the economic deprivation of the coronavirus pandemic, who are they? They are the black community and other minorities, but certainly the black community, who are not only under-resourced and suffering from the legacy and the existence of racism, but who also happen to be there on our front lines. These are the people who we're meant to be clapping every single week and saying thank you for being the heroes of this moment. And yet they're the ones bearing the brunt of all this violence. And so what we've had is today, there will be, at about the same time as George Floyd's funeral in Houston, there will be a protest at Oxford University, and they will again rally around the very, very divisive issue and subject of Cecil Rhodes, who, as you know, was the colonial leader who colonized Zimbabwe, then Rhodesia, etc., and who's been an incredible divisive force on campus by the black community there, black students. And maybe now we'll see something happen to his statue. We certainly saw it over the weekend protest in Bristol, where the statue of a 17th century slave trader by the name of Edward Colston was in scenes that I have not seen since, you know, we saw Lenin coming down in the Soviet Union and across the Eastern Bloc when the wall fell, when we saw Saddam coming down, his statue, Saddam Hussein, after the 2003 Iraq War. Here in the United Kingdom, we see the statue of a slave trader pulled down and thrust into the Bristol Harbor, because this guy became very rich on the sale of human beings. His ships would go from Bristol, they would dock in Africa, they would pick up their human cargo, and then go on to the United States, to America. And these are issues, that historical issues that people here are reckoning with, but then, of course, there's the real day-to-day issues of racism in ways that still unfairly penalize people because of the color of their skin.
And we've, in this country too, had a statue of Frank Rizzo come down in Philadelphia, former mayor considered racist by many people for some of the things that he did. A statue of a Confederate general in Richmond came down in Virginia. And so it's interesting to hear that as people are reckoning with the present through the movement, people are also reckoning with the past. And sometimes it takes the form of taking down statues. I wonder if, before we get to some phone calls, if you see any particular reforms, either in the UK or other countries that you're looking at, that are rising to be front and center. Like here, after you're on, we're going to talk to a leader of the New York State Legislature about specific reforms that they passed there yesterday and will pass later in this week, including banning chokeholds and making it easier to look at police officers' disciplinary records. Then we'll talk to a leader of the U.S. Congress, Gerald Nadler, at the federal level, of course, where they're doing other things. So there are legislative responses now to the protest movement. Are you seeing that elsewhere?
We're not seeing anything in actual reaction here to George Floyd's killing, but we have seen in the past, you know, attempts at reform. But I think what we have to understand is that reform can be a mealy-mouthed slogan if it's not something that really deals with root cause of what's going on. Sometimes you can say reform and it can just be cosmetic, or it can be legislated and it can be put into, you know, into the law books, but it's not carried out. I mean, for instance, on chokeholds and things like that, why was that still going on? I mean, you know, so clearly there's a lot to be done that is more than just paying lip service when we talk about reform. But I think that, you know, for me, I guess I recognize what's going on the streets of America, because I feel like in different ways, obviously, I've covered these movements in other parts of the world. Mm-hmm. And I've asked myself, and I've asked our viewers, why is it when I and my fellow correspondents, camera people, are eyewitnesses to freedom and democracy uprisings in authoritarian regimes and dictatorships and places around the world, why is it that we immediately gravitate towards there, we rush to cover it, and we describe them as, you know, movements and uprisings for freedom and democracy, for dignity and for justice? And yet, in the United States, The critics at the beginning, they seem to have been toned down right now, but the critics in the beginning, particularly from the top leadership, would call them thugs and radicals and all the rest of it. And I remember, well, obviously you all know this better than I do, but Senator Robert Kennedy, when he was running for president in 1968, he spoke to the people immediately in the aftermath of Martin Luther King's assassination. He tried to not just calm anger on the street, but but understand what was going on and admit that the state also bore responsibility if there are, when there are violent state institutions and or institutions that use violence and that, you know, meet any kind of protest with violence. And I think that's a really important thing for leaders to understand and to admit and to realize that that breeds a cycle of violence and retribution and violence and retribution and death and killing. And that's the kind of thing that I think leaders need to understand right now.
Jackie in East Brunswick, you're on WNYC with Christiane Amanpour. Hi, Jackie.
Hi, my name is Jackie. My pronouns are she and her. I'm originally from Brazil, where our racial mixture is quite different from the United States. We are a lot more integrated. We have far more interracial couples. We have entire states of brown people, but we still have racism. And it's really difficult to talk about it because we decided over the years to just pretend it's not there. What happened in the United States recently offered an opportunity to bring those issues to the front of our, to bring it to our, inside our households. We have racism within our own families. We take it very personally. And it's extremely difficult for us to bring those issues up. Exactly because of that, everybody will take it personally. But what happened in the United States here, it all started with like one complaint about one item in the racist menu, and now we decided to talk about the whole thing. And everything is being put on the table. And this is an opportunity of a lifetime.
Is it happening?
With the kind of leadership we have in Brazil right now.
Is it happening in Brazil too now that, as you beautifully put it, the whole thing is being put on the table?
Yes, yes. I have family members in Brazil participating on protests against police brutality, against racism, institutional racism, as we speak. I have people on the ground there right now that I'm very proud of, very proud of, because I know how difficult it is for you to go to your white father. As a brown person, you go to your white father, okay, so now we're going to talk about that name that you used to call me when I was a kid, the racial name. I called my mother and say, send me pictures of the burns, because my mom used to be a a cleaner for a white family in Brazil, and she used to be burned with hot embers.
Oh my.
And hot iron as a punishment for doing something wrong. And my mom is still alive. So we have to bring those things out. She was able to deal with that and forgive everybody that wronged her. I still hate them. I still have hate for them. Mm. And I thought it was a good opportunity for us to talk about it so I could get a little closure and maybe transform hate, which is a problem, into something else that is part of a solution.
Wow. Jackie, thank you so much for that take from the personal to the national. Wow. In the case of your family and of Brazil, thank you so much. Dante calling from Madrid, Spain. Dante, hello from New York. You're on WNYC.
Hi, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me. I'm an American, but I've been living in Spain for the last year and a half. I'm also a black man, and I happened to be at the protest that took place in Madrid on Sunday. And it was very interesting because originally the organizers had only received permission for a gathering of like 200 or 300 people. And I think it was upwards of 3,000 people that showed up, not just expats, but Spaniards. And I think it was really powerful because in Spain, there is sort of rhetoric that racism is something that happens in other places, that it's not something that happens here. And so it was really a really powerful opportunity for sort of an intersection between what's going on in the United States right now, and also Spain's relationship with black people and black bodies, because as I'm sure you know, people trying to make their way to Spain from Africa are regularly detained and sometimes killed at the border between usually Morocco and the Spanish enclaves in
Dante,
in
I'm curious if it was harder to get that message out about domestic racism in Spain because the protest you're describing was in front of the U.S. Embassy. So that made it look like, and maybe it made the Spanish media focus on, I don't know, Spanish people standing up and saying, look what those Americans are doing, as opposed to something more global and internal.
I think that it was, the organizers did a really great job because there is like a, there's a Black Lives Matter chapter of organizers in Spain. But then we also worked with organizers who focus on domestic issues. And so, like, it did begin, you know, because the death of George Floyd and all of the other, you know, murders by police brutality were the catalyst for this thing. That is where we began. But the protest was so large that we actually ended up marching through the city, that we did not stay in front of the embassy. We marched to Puerta del Sol, which is sort of like a center plaza in central Madrid. Mm-hmm. And the things that we were chanting as we went were not just, you know, no justice, no peace, but we also were chanting, you know, no human being is illegal, because that's sort of the way that manifests itself here.
Yeah.
Right.
Dante, so, thank you so much. So illuminating for U.S. listeners. Thank you for calling us from Madrid. Christian, you want to react in any way to any of those callers? And I'm also curious, since Dante brought up the phrase Black Lives Matter being chanted there in Madrid, this originated in the United States. Is it something that you're seeing having caught on as a phrase around the world?
Oh, 100%. 100%. As I said, the foreign minister of Iran tweeted Black Lives Matter. And this, by the way, goes to the issue of American credibility on a broad range of values around the world. But in the protests here and elsewhere, that is the main rallying cry. That is the main sign that you see, as well as no justice, no peace. The two are intrinsically linked. And it's the kind of, you know, no justice, no peace I've seen around the world in different places as well. And we mustn't underestimate what that means. It means no justice, no peace. It's very real. It's not just a slogan. It's the result and the root cause for social upheaval and social unrest. This is an uprising, what's happening in the United States. Much of as I've witnessed around the world in the, I don't know, 30-odd years I've been a foreign correspondent. And we shouldn't mistake what we see in front of very eyes. And if I could just address, you know, some of the violence, it just infuriates me that a moral equivalence is placed on the peaceful protests and the isolated occasional acts of violence, which we know by and large, especially in New York, because we've heard it from the police commissioner involved, that many of those are organized agitators. They have supply lines. They have been arrested, most of them from out of state, at least in a certain period that I read about. And I think we should be very, very careful not to equate and not to create a false moral equivalence or a false factual equivalence mm-hmm. between the legitimate right of people to protest and to raise their voices and to march for justice, as opposed to, you know, fringe elements which may be creating some kind of violence. And I think we should also remember, and we shouldn't forget, because the scenes are almost unbearable to watch, that even in the midst of this reckoning, even in the midst of this awakening in the United States, we still see police brutality and violence against those who are marching and protesting. I've seen this in Egypt. I've seen it in Iran. I've seen it in many, many parts of the world. I did not expect to see it in the United States of America. So this is very, very important moment. I would say that Jackie from Brazil, who was talking to you, you know, as a reporter and as a, you know, a follower of the human story, mm-hmm. I can barely even breathe when I hear what happened to his mother, that she was burnt by embers and by hot metal rods. I mean, what?
Really? Yes.
This is 2020. What? Seriously? These are human beings. And I think that I guess to talk about how do you emerge from this institutional, you know, canyon that one's in, cultural canyon of darkness? I think you have to start with truth and reconciliation, to coin a phrase from South Africa. And I was speaking to the former executive secretary of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, who said that, look, it's one thing to know the truth, and it's another thing to acknowledge the truth, because you can know it and ignore it, but if you acknowledge it, you have to act and fix it. So truth and reconciliation has never happened in the United States in any formal way whatsoever, or maybe not even in any informal way. And there's a lot to reckon with, whether it's slavery, whether it's the current racism, whether it's what happened to Native Americans. I mean, there's a lot for the state to reckon with. And unless there is an acknowledgement and knowledge and a promise to change it, you can have all the truth you want. You can have all the cameras. You can have all the eyewitnesses. You can have all the journalists. And it still won't make a hill of beans difference. So that's why George Floyd matters, because maybe his unacceptable execution will be the tipping point that makes the society acknowledge what's going on and start the painful process of moving forward, because it will be difficult and it will be painful and there will be resistance and there will be people trying to deflect it. And I also can't help but remember at the very beginning, you know, in many cities, mayors and others came out, and activists. And in Atlanta, there was Killer Mike, a rapper, a musician, an activist, who came out. And he said, look, the bottom line is that we have to, hopefully I'm not going to get it wrong, but he basically said, plot and plan, strategize, mobilize, and you know, just move this forward now in a way that we, the community, must and can. Hopefully with the help of all society, but if not, we, the community, must do it. And that's what I'm hearing in London and other places as well. They're tired and fed up and cynical that elected leaders will do the right thing, because they keep promising and they have failed in their promises. So many people are now saying, well, it's up to us as well. You know, we have to take charge of this and try to push this very important, you know, rock forwards along the road to justice.
Christiane, we have a few more minutes only in the segment, and I want to touch a couple of other things very briefly. There was a similar thing under George W. Bush after the Iraq War started. You and I talked about it at the time.
We did.
How the U.S. reputation as a leader for international cooperation and for democracy was hurt so badly by Bush's sort of thumbing his nose at the U.N. and other international institutions and launching that war mostly unilaterally. Many people called him a cowboy, you'll remember that word, and that when Barack Obama was elected president, one of his missions had to be to repair the damaged image of the U.S. abroad. And so I'm just curious how you would compare the world sees us under Trump to the way the world saw us under Bush.
Well, I haven't looked at the latest poll, but certainly in the last few months, I did read a poll in the newspapers which said that the level of American unpopularity around the world was as high as it was at the peak of the Iraq War. I would say, and I don't know whether you call it splitting hairs, that the difference then was because it was a war that was conducted, and it wasn't because of the systematic repression of, you know, people in the United States. And the difference is that, you know, the current administration in the United States falls into a sort of authoritarian, you know, segment of the spectrum of leadership. At least that's what people are saying, and that's what people see in terms of identifying with authoritarian tropes, identifying with authoritarian leaders around the world, like from China to Russia to the Philippines to Brazil, we were just talking about, Hungary, all of those kinds of leaders the current administration sort of praises and identifies with. And allies, democratic allies, are pulling their hair out because they believe that this current administration is making them less safe, first of all by, you know, pulling out of the Iran nuclear deal, unilaterally pulling out of the climate accord, and then all of this other stuff. President Trump is threatening to pull American troops out of their stations in Germany. This has historically been to protect Europe from, you know, expansionist then Soviet Union, now Russia, etc. So there's a different level. of unpopularity and suspicion right now. It's for slightly different reasons. And I would say that, you know, no matter how unpopular George Bush was during the Iraq War, enabled by his, you know, I would say, you know, partisans in the U.S. media and in Congress, et cetera, I would say that at least then there was more talk with allies. There wasn't this me first. You didn't have America first or Trump first. Then it wasn't like that. There was still lip service, at least, and actual action paid to alliances and to multilateralism and to trying to sort out the world's problems together. So I think that the situations are very different, but the levels of unpopularity are fairly much the same right now.
And yesterday, George W. Bush announced that even he, as a former Republican president, will not be able to vote for his party mate, Donald Trump, for re-election this year. Christian Amanpour, host of Christian, I'm going to do that again. Christian Amanpour, host of Amanpour on, and Company on PBS and CNN internationally. And she is CNN's chief international correspondent. Christian, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast, is obviously also a daily coronavirus podcast. Under the circumstances in our country right now, we'll keep staying on top of things to serve you the best we can. And remember, this podcast is excerpted from my live weekday call-in show, The Brian Lehrer Show. If you want to be a caller or just hear it live, it's from 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time on WNYC Radio in New York, or online at WNYC.org. You can also tweet a question at us anytime. Just tweet at Brian Lehrer. Thanks for listening today.